All right, welcome back to another episode of the TFD Performance Podcast. We're back on the Dietitian Casting Couch. Back with Ryan, the Dojo Dietitian. Jack, the Combat Crab.
Why am I the Combat Crab?
It was
Big Jackie, Combat Jack, Pineapple Jack, and now it's a Combat Crab.
I hope this doesn't stick. The first thing when I saw you in the gym doing that weird thing, and I was like, man,
the weird thing.
That's a crab. You're laying down doing bench press or something. Like, you're doing half a bench press.
And shout out Matty Cass.
Is that an actual move? Is Matty Cass, if you're watching, is that a move? Is it called the crab? Because it looks like a crab.
That's just not a bicep curl, bud.
Yeah, I don't want to know about it then. So, topic today. I feel like this is one we're very, 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 very qualified to talk about. The best way to cut weight for a fighter. And what I want to do for this is I want to go through the process of what we do with our athletes, with our clients, with our combat athletes, to give you guys an insight of what it actually takes to plan a weight cut safely and the level of detail that is necessary to make sure you're doing this and getting the most out of your performance and your recovery. So when you get in the cage, ring, or on the mat, or whatever it is, you're doing that in the best shape possible. So what we're going to do is talk through our entire process. We've only got, 20, 25 minutes, so we're not going to go balls to the wall and go super in-depth. We'll send you to places where you can get way more in-depth knowledge afterwards, but I do want to give you guys an overview of this. So first things first, let's go with you, Doge. Someone shoots us an email. They're coming on board as a client. What's the first thing we do when we're looking through all the assessment with them?
Yeah, so when we get someone new in the door, obviously we want to kind of know a few things before we can determine whether or not it's even going to be like a realistic cut. So obviously you want to know first things, how long have we got to make the weight? It's also really important to kind of get an idea of where they're at in terms of body composition. So we'll get all of our clients to get a body scan or some sort of body composition assessment to make sure we've actually got enough body fat to lose to get down to the intended weight, and we can kind of go into all that as well. We also look at things like blood. So in this particular population, it is a group of people who sometimes will engage in pretty dangerous
sometimes most of the time
nutrition strategies to try and get down. We've all heard some crazy things, so very restrictive. People will cut out entire food groups, and there's a lot of room for deficiencies here, so we want to just double check, make sure that everything is like under the surface is functioning normally. We're not deficient in anything. So we'll get a couple of blood tests done. So we've got the blood test, we've got the questionnaire. We'll do a questionnaire with them to get an idea of what their normal eating habits are, because we want to obviously make this, a plan that's tailored and realistic for them to follow. And then kind of work back from using the time that we've got. Okay, we want to get to this particular weight. How do we work back from that to where we are now, so we know how much we need to be losing each week in order to get down there safely?
Yeah, and if there's a few good points to unpack there. I think the first one, we'll go to that body composition, because this is the biggest mistake I see athletes make initially. And I'm pretty sure I was guilty of it when I did like my first comp that I had to make weight for, is picking a weight class. You kind of just walk into a room and then your coach is like, you're kind of this tall, this like big, you know, you should go to this one. And that pretty much the vetting process. And how many athletes do we get where they come in and then they're like, oh, I'm going to this weight class. You go, okay, cool. Get a DEXA scan, comes back, and we go, holy, but there is zero chance you're making that. Or if they are making it, it's like, you must be going through hell. And they go, oh yeah, it's terrible. But isn't this what cutting weight is? And you go, no, this is not what cutting weight is. This is what killing yourself is. And I think that's the first thing, is picking an appropriate weight class. And that comes from getting a body composition scan. I think first point, I'll let you talk on it, Jack, because you spend a lot of time in Thailand in places where they don't always have access to it, right? So what are the things that people can be doing, say if they straight away, they go, good for you, but I can't get a body composition scan.
When I work with people in terms of in places that don't have access to body composition scans, I generally, you know, if it depends, like, one, I ask them if they can do, like, maybe they can get skin calipers. That's the most, like, kind of, you know, basic method, which is wildly kind of accessible to a lot of people. So that's basically some sort of determinant that we can use to kind of figure out how much body fat they have, and then we can kind of work with that in terms of how much perceived muscle mass and tissue from there. But even if they can't do that, and say it's a very extreme area where they can't get anything done, I basically just discuss, or we can kind of look at pictures, or we discuss in terms of their level of leanness. I know that's very ambiguous in terms of just the visuals to it, but that's kind of the most extreme level. But in any sense of that, it's kind of we're really just trying to determine the smallest amount that we can kind of negotiate with someone.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point on that one because we always talk about DEXs and we always say, oh, get a DEXer. DEXs are not always accurate. There's a lot of pros and cons to using DEXs, but like you never hear us say that they are. And this is the thing people go, oh, well, I can't get a DEXer. I can't get an in-body. I can't just like, okay, what can you get? Because we're not doing this necessarily to get an exact number of where you're at. We need to just know where in the ballpark you are and is it realistic for you to get to that weight? Because I know looking at DEXA scans and in-bodies that they're not accurate. But as long as we can be consistently inaccurate when we're tracking this and we've got some ballpark measure of where you're at, I know whether you're going to be struggling to make weight or we can do it pretty comfortably. And this is a big point because someone goes, oh, I can't afford to get a DEXA. I can't get an in-body. It's like, cool. Well, let's do pitches. Let's do calipers. Let's do something so we can get an idea so we're not just throwing random weight classes out here and coach being like, hey, Dojo, you're this tall. Go be a featherweight. And you're like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, I'm going to cut two legs off.
Yeah. Like, I had this conversation with someone when I was training in Thailand. He kind of asked me those questions. We were in Phuket and there wasn't an in-body scan available to him at the time. And I kind of just was explaining this. He wanted to go this drastically low weight class and I just walked up to him and I'm like, take your shirt off, took your shirt off, and I started pinching him and showing him that this guy was shredded to the bone. He had minimal body fat. And I said to him, explain to him, so if I'm pinching there, I'm not pinching any fat. This is just skin and muscle tissue. Where are we gonna lose this 5-6 kilos that you want to be losing before the final cut? Where is this coming from? And you can see him, and then he's kind of realizing, he's like, oh, that's true. As simple as that, kind of looking at like objectively, it's just like, where's it going to come off? Or, you know, kind of using those markers is an essential way of doing it if you don't have access to such technology.
Yeah, because first point I find with these guys, if you get the super lean guy come in, and we'll talk about why this is and why having, say, a DEXA can be super useful, super muscly, right? So they can cut weight really well. You restore a lot of fluid in those muscles through glycogen. We can probably manipulate their diet during fight week and they can probably move 10% of water weight in that fight week. So they think, yeah, I can get down that weight class pretty easy. I could probably go down another one. You're like, nah, that's not how it works. But that's what we're trying to determine when we're doing this assessment. It's like, where are you at? Because like you said, people don't always understand that they're losing body fat during the fight camp. I know that I say that out loud and people are like, well, obviously that, but no, a lot of people don't understand that. It's like, they don't understand where the weight's coming from. They don't know if it's coming off their muscle or where it's from. It's like, no, you need to be losing body fat because you need your muscle to train and be an athlete. We need to keep that, but we need to see that the body fat is there that we can lose. So the first thing, and this is the big point I'm trying to get to here, is that you don't want to be super shredded all year round if you're an athlete and you've got to cut weight. I think people get this idea, I've got to be super shredded, I've got to do this. Like, no, you kind of want a bit of extra body fat there so that during that fight camp, when we're planning your weight descent, we've got some actual weight to lose and body fat to play with. And then we'll go into your muscle and your water weight and we'll move that during the fight week. But let's talk about the next step. So we've gone through, we've established their weight class. We go, whatever, setting out their macros, setting out their calories. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So with this, and we've kind of talked about this on a previous podcast about like figuring out calories in, calories out, all that kind of stuff. What we find works and seems to be the most accurate and is part of the reason, like one of the benefits of getting a body composition test done, is if you calculate your calories and the macronutrients that you need based on your lean body mass rather than just like total body weight, it's generally going to make things a lot more accurate from the start because your fat mass isn't metabolically active, which just means it's not really going to contribute much at all to like your energy output. Like it's just kind of there. your muscle mass and all the other things that you've got in your body is what contributes to your energy expenditure and stuff like that. So by getting those body scans done, you're able to make more accurate predictions of what the person's what your own energy output is going to be. And then we can start building around, okay, this is how many calories we need. And then once we've got the calorie limit, now we've got something to work with. So we know this is our upper limit. Now we need to make sure we're getting in enough protein, enough carbs, and enough fat within that limit so that we're still ticking the boxes to be losing weight, but we're not sacrificing anything in terms of like not getting enough protein in to support your like the lean muscle mass or things like that. Do you want to start going over some of the numbers in terms of the macros and how we fit that into the calories?
Yeah, I think throw it out there. And I think the best thing anyone who's into this field, and if you're looking at it, there's a paper called Making Weight in Combat Sports, 2011 paper. I think it's just the Holy Grail. It sets up this principle called the 3-2-1 principle. Everyone who does this understands what this principle is. We all use it. Maybe it does or does not apply to the specific individual. That's up for you to decide with your other assessments and blah, blah. Great base camp. If that's your base camp, you should be using this. And the Cunningham equation is just 22 times your fat-free mass, isn't it? 22 times your fat-free mass plus 500 gives you your resting metabolic rate. And what they talk about in this paper is that it's probably a fairly good idea to eat at your resting metabolic rate and then just increase for higher or lower training days. And you can do what they call the fuel for the work required and periodize your carbohydrates. But if you're sitting here listening, you go, man, I don't even know how to work out my calories. I've tried all these online calculators. The Cunningham equation is kind of the gold standard when we're talking about cutting weight and combat sports nutrition.
Especially for athletes, I think it's been validated for as like the population that it works for the best.
Yeah, and it seems to work. I mean, obviously there's going to be outliers. And I think the big thing for that is you need to get some sort of gauge on their activity level because some guys will be training way more and way less. But Cunningham equation as your baseline calories, I find is probably the best one you can do.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing also. So obviously we're talking about, Dojo spoke about the blood work at the start. We've got the body composition, the breakdown, the fat-free mass and how we're calculating that. And also we're factoring in the questionnaire with the lifestyle factors. Me and you, Jordy, spoke about this the other day in talking about the output of someone's job because most of these athletes do have jobs as well. So we're also factoring in the data from obviously these important concepts, but also their lifestyle factors. So you've really got to understand, obviously, there's their training schedule, but you're talking about the lifestyle factors, again, what we spoke about in terms of the calories in, calorie out podcast as well. But again, we've really got to factor in the lifestyle as well. That's why we're not only just seeing the questionnaire as a way to kind of understand that person as an individual, but on a deeper level in terms of what would their caloric needs be in general and how to fit that in terms of giving them the best chance to successfully lose weight for that camp, but also be fueled for training and recovery, but also to be, have the energy levels to get through their daily lives.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to get caught up in numbers when it comes to nutrition, but at the end of the day, we're working with like people, not robots. So I think it's really important to consider all that stuff and make sure that the plan is structured in a way that it's going to fit your lifestyle, because we've talked about it before, but like the best diet to follow is one that you can actually follow consistently. So you need to be able to take into account the fact that, okay, you might be someone who likes snacking, or you might be someone who prefers to just eat big meals a couple of times a day and work around that rather than trying to like work against it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and we'll get into that because that's a question they always ask me. Intermittent fasting is always a topic combat athletes love because they associate it with losing more weight. And just, we'll talk about this in another podcast. As long as you get the calories right, it doesn't matter where you eat. If you do the eating window, if you fast or what, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to say that now. Intermittent fasting is not more advantageous if you're in a calorie deficit. And when it comes to this population, how you put your macros throughout your day or how you structure your intake is important because it's going to determine how good you show up to training and how well you recover. And I think that's the next part of this conversation. Once we do the Cunningham equation or whatever equation it is, we find their baseline calories, you work out all their macros, and throughout Making Weight in Combat Sports, they talk about this 3-2-1 principle, which is 3 grams of carbs per kilogram of body weight, 2 grams per kilogram of body weight for protein, and then 1 gram per kilogram body weight for fat. And that kind of gives you a good structure of how you should assign the calories that you get from the Cunningham equation to your macros. But again, it's base zero, it's base camp. Some people are going to be living more active lifestyle, so they're going to need more calories. They're going to need more carbohydrates. Some people might prefer more fat in their diet, so you wind back on the protein, or you might wind up on the protein, depending what the goal is. That's a really good base camp though. Cunningham equation, get your calories, and then use the 3-2-1 principle to set your macros.
That's exactly right. It's a principle. It's not like a hard and fast rule. So it's good as a starting point, but you kind of need to like adjust it to the situation.
I think this leads us to the next part, which I think is for an optimal athlete is one of the most essential components, which is the periodization of the macronutrients.
Yeah. And I think that's super, super important, especially when we talk about combat sports, because this is coming from like, we've done lots of sports right in our life. And I think combat sports are so physically tolling. Very, very hard training sessions, short, sharp, explosive. Like we describe these sports from an energetic standpoint as being glycolytic, and that's a big word. And what it means is you just predominantly burn carbohydrates because you're operating at a percent intensity of your VO2 max. So pretty much training really fucking hard for most of the time, which means your body is going to be using carbohydrates most of the time. And this is the next biggest thing that combat athletes do. And I was guilty of it. First time I ever cut weight, first thing I did was just cut carbohydrates out, because in my mind, this, I had 2 nutrition degrees when I did this. I was thinking, nah, if I just cut the carbs, I'll lose weight fast. And it was a horrendous experience, not knowing that I was training 2-3 times a day, burning into this glycolytic system, the carbohydrate system, but I had no carbs there. I had no carbs to fuel it. So what Jack is saying, periodizing carbohydrates, is just basically a fancy way of saying, hey, if you're doing a really, really tough session, you've got to put in a really, really good amount of carbohydrates to support that. Hey, if you're just doing shadow boxing, if you're just drilling, if you're just rolling, just sitting in an ice bath doing fuck all, like, you don't need as many carbohydrates. That's what we talk about, periodizing your high days with high carbohydrate, lower days with less carbohydrates, moderate days with, you know, obviously moderate carbohydrates.
Yeah, I think you see that a lot with, you know, a lot of people followed a sort of bodybuilding style diet, which is not saying that bodybuilding isn't hard or weight resistance training isn't difficult.
But generally
the intensity of those sessions.
Pick up a weight and drop it. Come on.
Well, the intensity of those sessions are generally the same.
Punch you back. Come on.
It's not.
Well, I'm not a bodybuilder, so I'm not defending. I'm just trying to.
I'm just saying.
Playing devil's advocate, mate. Far.
Last week. Like, and everyone, though, you would have got this. Like, especially with, like, jujitsu. Like, I think it's a bit different with Muay. I remember very distinctly a bodybuilder punching me in the face and it did hurt. But I remember in jujitsu, we're digressing, but I remember even last week, the first time.
You haven't shot a Muay Thai again?
No, the first time. You would hit that bill to say level 207. Oh, no, the moose sixes. The
moose is going to sort him out.
207.
The dietitian's getting pizza.
No, 2 weeks ago. And we've all seen it in jiu-jitsu. A big bodybuilder dude rocks up, comes in, and they're super staunch. And then they get flipped and rolled and contorted by like the 16-year-old white belt who half has no idea what he's doing. But it just shows, like, I'm not saying bodybuilding isn't tough and whatever, but it's not a sport. I call it what it is. It's not a sport. Don't say it. It's like,
all right,
and you see it when we're talking about these energetic demands and output. Bodybuilders don't need a high carb diet because they don't do high carb workouts.
Yeah,
like, I'm taking pretty hard shots at them, but it's deservedly.
This is triggered someone over on my left, but we digress. What I was trying to explain is that when we're talking the periodization, especially the carbohydrates, is that when you're working with combat sport athletes, there'll be certain days like when you're eating high. But I think, like, we all have, you know, you look at the training schedule and there'll be a sparring day, and you know that the sparring day, if it's once a week or twice a week or 3 times a week.
5 times a week if you do Muay Thai.
Yeah, basically every day. That's why I couldn't say 1, 2, or 3. But it's for most athletes, a very important day, not just because it's obviously a high output day, because obviously you want to feel optimal as well, because that's basically a fight simulation. So it's very important to know that you need to structure having such a high day or like a high day of carbohydrates to make sure they're performing optimally in these things, because you know, one's going to be high output. Two, it's going to be psychologically very important them to feel good in those sessions, because predominantly it's basically seen as like a simulation of the fight to come, depending what gym you're at.
I think this is a really simple or like an easy thing for people to slip into at the start for like a couple of reasons with carbs. Like, because we hear like the saying kind of tossed around that carbs is like not an essential nutrient, which technically speaking, like, your body can produce its own carbohydrates and stuff. So realistically, like, yes, like it's not an essential nutrient, but if you're training and you're an athlete, it becomes essential because these sessions, as Jordy said, are glycolytic. They're so heavily dependent on having carbohydrates that if you're not doing what Jack's saying and fueling around those sessions, having more carbohydrates before bigger sessions or definitely before more high intensity sessions, you're going to be losing out on a lot, right? You're going to be losing out on being able to push in terms of, you know, getting like calorie output up during those sessions. You're going to lose out on being able to concentrate and learn in the session. And you're also going to be losing out on like physical adaptations, because a lot of the adaptations you get to training come from being able to push yourself to a certain level where you're driving these like biological responses to training. So like muscle breakdown and being able to push your cardiovascular system and stuff like that. You need to have the carbohydrates in there to fuel those sessions. And so cutting them out seems like an easy solution at the start. And for a lot of people, you'll notice early on, if you cut carbs out, you'll drop weight quickly. But this is something we see, and you see it as well in ketogenic diet, which it does that. It cuts, that's what ketogenic diet is. It's like really low carbohydrate, and people will lose a lot of weight really quickly. So people will do that at the start of a fight camp or something, maybe lose a kilo or two within the first week or two. And that's like super exciting, but they haven't actually potentially lost any body weight, because one thing that happens when you cut carbs out is you lose the body's stores of carbohydrates, which is glycogen. And with glycogen, you store a lot of water, and the glycogen in your body is actually quite heavy. So you cut out carbs, you can lose weight really quickly, but it's not actual body weight change. It's not body composition change. You're just losing a bunch of water weight. And then once you've lost that, you can't like re-lose it again in fight week. So it makes fight weeks harder, because there's not a lot of room to move in terms of weight manipulations and stuff like that. So I think, as Jordy was saying, like, it's rather than cutting them out completely, we need to keep them in and make sure that we're really tailoring the plan so that we can maximize the amount of carbs we're having before trainings while staying in that calorie deficit.
Yep, I think that leads us on to the next part. So we've spoken about, obviously, assessment process, figuring out the calories and the macro split, and obviously how to put that into then leading on to periodization of a nutrition plan. And now this next part is about planning the weight loss process, or how much to lose over a certain amount of time. Now, I think time and time again, you obviously have a process in which we aim to lose, say, 1% of your body weight in those weeks leading up to the weigh-in day. But what happens when you don't consistently lose weight, or what happens when you see stagnation on the scales?
Yeah, I mean, we'll take a step back and we'll go from like planning, like Jack said, it's all well and good to plan your diet and you get your macros and you set everything up and you periodize your nutrition. It's funny, we're talking about carbohydrates. We literally just ordered a pizza. And then you do all that, but you still need to lose the weight and you need to lose the body fat. So you need to make sure you're in that calorie deficit. But there's a big difference between being in an appropriate calorie deficit and a large calorie deficit, and how much weight you lose is a good indication of that. Because if you're losing too much weight too fast, you can slip into what we call low energy availability, or acute low energy availability. And like Dojo said, if you're too deep in that ditch, you can be getting some serious problem. Like metabolically, you get into a lot of problems. You see fighters get really sick during fight camp because their immune system's compromised. They get all these gut problems. Their mental health goes to crap. All of these things happen. Like, they just don't sleep properly because they're too low in a calorie deficit. So planning how much weight you lose each week is really, really important. Like Jack said, 1% is kind of bang on. We go anywhere from 1 to 2% of your body weight per week. And like, if I'm 70 kilos, 1% is 700 grams. 2% is 1.4 kilos. Like, that's a fair amount of weight to consistently be losing. So we come back to the assessment. This is why it's so important to look at an assessment and a body composition scan and go, is there that weight to lose? Like, can we even lose 1.4 kilos per week for 8 weeks and then cut 10% body water in that 5 weeks? Is that even realistic? But I think when you're planning this, 1% is probably safe. I even push back and go 0.5% is probably more appropriate. And then, like we'll talk about, that 10% during fight week. But really, you don't want to be going too deep in that. And each week, if you're waking up and you're going, I'm losing 2-3%, it's too much. It's way too much. And when you're planning, if you're thinking, can I make that weight? And then you work out the numbers and you need to do that, not worth doing, because you're just going to cook yourself. You're not going to have a good fight camp. You're going to rock up to fight week absolutely fried. You go into that cage, you're going to be cooked. So if you're planning your weight descent, 0.5 to 1%, I think is completely appropriate.
Yeah, I think so. And I think for anyone listening in, they're obviously interested in like the diet side of it and the weight loss side of how to plan a fight camp and all that kind of thing. But like, you really kind of have to think, at the end of the day, you're doing this to fight. Like, the main purpose of the whole fight camp is to prepare for the fight, to train, to do all that stuff. And if you're doing those things, Jordy said, just like, if you're dropping weight too quickly, you're not fueling properly, like, maybe you get weight a little bit easier or whatever, but or faster, or maybe you can achieve a weight in like a shorter amount of time, but you're taking away from like the main part of the camp, which is preparing for the fight. So your training is not going to be as good. You're not going to be able to hit the same intensities. You're probably not going to be able to hit the same training quality, and like the skill development and stuff is just not going to be the same as if you are hitting a more moderate deficit. You're fueling properly for your sessions and you're just ticking all the boxes. rather than doing things way too drastically.
And coming back to Jack's point then of what happens when you don't lose weight, I think the biggest problem that you'll come across is that it's not losing weight. Like, there's lots of things you can do. You can increase your activity, you can change your intake, you can change different types of output. That's okay when you're only losing 0.5% to 1% per week, because you could probably catch up on it later on in the camp. But if you're programmed to lose 3% of your body weight every week, and then you start stalling for 2 weeks, you're going, oh crap. If you're planning to lose that much, you're probably in a crazy calorie deficit as it is. You're probably training through the roof. So where's our wiggle room? What are we doing here? Like, what are we doing to adjust here? It's like, we probably don't have it. So even from that sense, planning a less aggressive cut during the fight camp is probably very advantageous, because more than likely, it's not going to be a linear process. It's going to be up and down. There's lots of factors that contribute to that. But then when you have to deal with that plateau, it's not going to be as brutal as if you're relying on huge weight loss each week.
100%. And I also think, you know, it's very important to understand like why you fluctuate. Like, Dojo's done a Instagram post about the fluctuations and understanding that. And also, in addition to that, is not weighing yourself constantly through the process and kind of getting set back in terms of what your weight's doing, and kind of understand this process is never linear, understand there is fluctuations, and kind of getting time points throughout the week, so you can kind of average out what your weight is doing and kind of making assessment from there, rather than kind of altering your intake according to a certain weigh-ins in just every day.
Yeah, I think it's probably good to understand, like, and I guess this is a good opportunity for us to reassure the people listening in as well. Weight fluctuations are totally normal during a camp. Like Jack just touched on there, your weight loss isn't just going to look like a straight line from like where you start to like your fight weight. And obviously the more time points you're taking, the more time you measure your weight. So if you're weighing like every day, it's a good way to kind of like mentally fuck yourself a little bit, because you will see all those like ups and downs as it'll trend down over time, but you're not necessarily going to be losing weight every single day. And as Jack said, we've put out some content about this, but just to kind of like briefly run over those things, there's a bunch of reasons why your weight can fluctuate day to day, and being aware of those, like some of them can cause fluctuations, a couple hundred grams up to like a couple kilograms, depending on you know, how much food you're eating, how much you're hydrating, your training levels, all that kind of thing. It can make a big impact on your weight day to day. And if we're only looking for really like moderate weight changes, that sort of stuff can potentially outweigh actual weight change that's going on under the surface. And so if you're weighing every day and maybe not even losing like a couple hundred grams a day, because you're looking to lose a couple hundred grams over the week, but your weight is fluctuating a couple of hundred grams a day, you're not going to be able to see that weekly change on the scales. And so I think it's a really good point, Jack, to not fixate on weighing every day here, because the fluctuations will really kind of get in the way of seeing the change. What we're looking for in terms of weight change during a camp is not day-to-day weight change, but more like week-to-week. So picking a time once a week where it's consistent, you've trained a similar amount the day before, you've eaten a similar amount the day before, sleep is similar, you've been to the toilet and got off any excess weight that way, and picking like a protected time to weigh yourself and doing that like once a week rather than every single day, you're a lot less likely to see these like bounces happening that way. And even if you do see a plateau, it's still like, you're probably better off like looking into these other options of why that's happened first before just being like, oh shit, my weight's the same as it was last week. This week, I'm going to cut it by 1,000 calories, because that's when you're going to start running into problems with training, feeling sick, and all these other things that come with dropping the calories too quickly.
Yeah, I think in a summary, because we want to get to the fight week stuff, which is why a lot of people will be listening. Yep. Summary, get an assessment. Figure out if your weight class is for you. Body composition assessment through DEXA, InBody. If you need to get calipers, or I've done it with clients where you just look at photos and like they send you and then you kind of compare and you need something. DEXA, I think, is obviously the best one if we can get access to it. Lots of different options. If you can't, you need a plan. Your intake, we recommend Making Weight Combat Sports 2011, great paper. We use the Cunningham equation, base camp for your calories, 3-2-1 principle, set up your macros. Within that, periodize your carbohydrates for your high days, low days, set your weight loss. We only really want to be setting 0.5%, 1%. You can do more, you can do up to 2%. I'm fine with guys doing 2% if they've done it in the past. If We're not relying so much on the fight week. We won't get into that. But now let's talk about when we get to the actual fight week, because this is the good stuff. And I think there's a lot to be said. 10% of your body weight, I think, is what everyone says. You can say, yeah, you know what? I can come in this fight week and in 5 days, I'm going to lose 10%. You say that to the random person off the street, they'll think you're a fucking lunatic. But it's the reality. You can shift 10% of your body weight in water weight, which is a big thing. If you're listening to this and you're not familiar with what weight cutting is, this is water weight. All the fat loss that's going to happen in this happens in those 8 weeks during your fight camp before you get to this point. Once you get to this point, no more fat loss is happening. You're at your leanest, and we're going to start manipulating fluid from different fluid compartments in your body. And we're going to talk about the different strategies that we do that to get up to 10%. And then we're going to finish off talking about whether we think 10% is appropriate or not, whether you should be doing that. And I think that's going to be an interesting combo. But Dojo, let's just start talking about the strategies and we'll go pick one. We'll talk about that and we'll just break it down each one. We'll go 2 minutes for each one. We'll break it down.
Yeah, sure. So I guess the first one that I guess everyone will jump onto at the start of a fight week is going to be their water load. It's a really common one. A lot of people will probably already be familiar with it.
It's funny. Reed literally just texted me just as you said that.
Reed, the water loading man. Yeah. So actually Reed has some really good interesting research out. Reed Real on water loading and how that actually works in the body. But it's basically just increasing your water to basically an excessive amount in order to increase your output of water. So I guess to brutally summarize what Reed found out through his research and probably butchered a little bit, is the idea is to kind of like increase the output of urine through changes that happen in your kidneys by having this increased excessive amount of water. And then towards the end of the week, you want to cut that out, and then that increased output will remain for a brief window of time, and that will help with shedding some excess water weight.
Yeah, and I think water loading, the big points I think you need to understand about it is that there is an upper limit. There's an upper limit, absolutely. What we know is that your kidneys can probably filter up to 16 liters of water a day. I would not recommend testing that upper limit because that is a lot of water. What Reel's research came out to say is that 100 mils per kilogram of body weight is probably safe. And in practice, I even think it's probably pretty high. You probably don't have to do that. What we tend to do is look at someone's habitual water intake and then increase that by a percentage, whether that's 25%, 50%, whatever's appropriate. Because if what Reed found out in his research is true, then there's a physiological change that you're trying to get, and it's the dose response isn't very well known. And 100 mil per kilogram was just an easy number for these guys to work out. It wasn't like this was the dose response that they found. So it could be higher, it could be lower. For me, I think I've water loaded before. I've literally done a podcast and pissed my pants when I was water loading. It can be a really like interruptive process. I tend to get the guys, especially the guys doing media and everything, like for 12 hours straight, not leaving their seat, go on the lower end. But again, it's an increase from your habitual intake. You can do it. And then there's, I guess the next part is when you cut it off, you can either cut it off 24 hours. That's what most people say. I kind of like to push that to 18 hours or 12 hours so they're not too dehydrated before they start the rapid dehydration, the sweating, which we'll talk about in a bit. But let's go on to the next strategy that we would use.
Everyone's favorite, glycogen depletion. So we're basically manipulating carbohydrate intake to basically reduce the amount of glycogen stores in the muscle and liver and basically have the reduction of water weight that attach that glycogen as a result. And then you see a decrease in scale weight.
Yeah, I think Dojo touched on it before, right? Glycogen is just the stored carbohydrate. We store it in our muscle and in our liver. And I'll come back to saying DEXAs because a lot of people give DEXAs stuff. Greg Duchette gave us a lot. Oh, well, who said that? You know, and it's like, we need that because, and why I'm giving bodybuilders shit is because it doesn't matter how much glycogen you have, dude. Like, we need to manipulate glycogen come fight week. So we need to know whether it's a ballpark figure or not, which it is. It's a ballpark range, but we still need to know if you've got this much lean mass, we can do an equation to figure out how much skeletal muscle mass or estimate how much skeletal muscle mass you have. And then we can take the dry weight of that muscle mass and figure out a percentage of it that's going to be glycogen. And that basically tells us, okay, there's this much stored carbohydrate in your muscle and in your liver. We know that water is going to attach to that. And we know how much water, or roughly how much water. So we can get this range of numbers. Hey, when you cut carbohydrates for this many days and we deplete that down to a certain level, we should lose this much weight. It's not a hard and fast number, but at least over the years, I found from the equation that we use to calculate this, we get a range. It's usually almost always bang in the middle. And it's a very, very, very good indication because it fills you with a lot of confidence when you do this strategy. Hey, we're actually going to get this much weight off.
And that's why it's so essential that going back, you've planned your carbohydrate intake throughout camp adequately.
Like Dojo said, you can't take away something that's not there. If you've cut carbs 8 weeks, which I'm guilty of, I've done it before. And then you try to cut that weight and people, how many clients, yeah. I cut carbs. Yeah, you cut carbs 6 weeks ago. What do you want me to do? Like we can't do anything.
Exactly.
So make sure you're eating carbs before you do this. So that's water loading, carb depletion.
So the next one is one that is probably the least impact, right? Like people probably don't notice it the most, but it will make a big difference in terms of just getting off excess weight, and that is to reduce or manipulate fiber intake. So this is basically just going to give your body a chance to clear all of the existing food matter that's in your digestive system. So obviously we know fiber is the indigestible part of plant foods that will take a while to kind of process through your digestive system and clear out the other end. So by cutting it out within a couple of days of the weigh-in, you give your body a time to clear everything, all of the food waste that's, well, not waste, but the food matter that's kind of already in your digestive system, to clear it out. And athletes can get anywhere up to a couple hundred grams by doing that.
I reckon my dog Moose would be a huge responder to a low fiber diet because he does at least 5-6 shits a day. And if you're watching this, you want me to do a self experiment and put my dog on a low fiber diet to see how much weight. Let's let the people decide, and we'll deal with the consequences from Peter later.
Okay, so yeah, fiber, and then the next one from there is going to be sodium. So this one kind of overlaps with some of the other methods, but do you want to go over sodium?
You got to give it to Sodium Boy here. He's
yeah.
A,
yeah,
okay. This is an interesting one because sodium is what we call osmotically active. And at the very start of this, I said we're going to lose 10% of our body weight from fluid, from different fluid compartments in our body. And what I mean by that is that our body isn't just like a giant balloon. If we put a pin in us, we wouldn't just explode in water, even though that we're 70% water. But that water is interspersed in different compartments throughout our body. The thing is that our body's only way of understanding and moving fluid between these apartments or compartments is by moving electrolytes and primary sodium. By moving sodium between these compartments is how we move fluid. So one of those massive compartments is just sitting in our blood, or what we call our extracellular space, so outside our cells. So our cells are what keeps us alive. There's huge spaces of fluids outside of them, and sodium hangs around in there. And if we're obviously eating a lot of sodium in our body, we have to process that and put it through our kidneys and we pee it out. If we reduce that sodium in our diet, we're going to reduce the amount of water that is held onto it. That's just going to be sitting in these open spaces, I guess you would say. So if you eat a very, very high salt diet, and go try it, go get a ramen bowl, go get a bowl of pho, eat it on nighttime, eat it 9 p.m. at night. Yeah, a pho, eat a pho. And then weigh yourself the next day. And what you're holding a lot of, you'll go, whoa, what the heck? Like, I'm heavy. And it's because you've put in so much sodium, and sodium draws water in your body. So you're holding more fluid just in this, what we call the extra space around our cells and everything else. And it's not because you put on weight, you're just holding water. And you might see people get a bit more like puffy around their face and things like that. And they feel a bit puffy because they've got the sodium. So if you remove that sodium, you remove a lot of that extra water, and we can manipulate that during fight week to make sure that we're removing this fluid and thus losing more weight.
Yeah, and I think this is probably something just to clarify quickly. Some people might not realize, like, the electrolytes you have in your drinks, like sports drinks and stuff, have sodium in them. So they're like, when you're removing sodium through fight week and you're like, oh my god, why is my water weight coming down, but you're still having like some sort of electrolyte drink after training sessions and stuff, that is part of that process.
Or your protein shake. Like, we tell people to eat a lot of protein during fight week, right? Because we're cutting carbohydrates down. You go, well, what do I eat? And you go, fat and protein. A lot of people will just use protein shakes. And protein shakes is coming from someone whereas a supplement company have a lot of sodium in it because you need it there as a preservative and as to mask flavors. Yeah. So you need to have a lot of sodium in there, and you could probably get half to 70% of the sodium that you're allowed to have each day during fight week in one protein shake. So guys don't realize that. They have the protein shake a couple times a day, then they have a sports drink after they work out, and they go, man, I'm following the low carb, I've cut the fiber, you know, I'm doing the water load. What the heck? I'm still holding. You go, yeah, because you're having heaps of salt in your diet.
Or forgetting the most common question, creatine.
Creatine. Yeah, I guess this is a little diverge a little bit. I always tell my guys, like, cut creatine before you get to fight week. I don't think you need to, though. I don't think you need to. If you habitually take creatine, it's fine to take. But we don't need to get in the psychological side of it. It's going to mentally mess you up. Put it out and put it back in your...
As a fail safe, we always take it out 7 days before weigh-ins.
But I think generally that's pretty much the four strategies that we're going to use. We're going to use a low-carb approach to get rid of that glycogen. We're going to manipulate our salt to get rid of that free extra water that's hanging around in those spaces in our body. We're going to get down fiber because we've got a really long gut. It takes a few days to get food through there. If we reduce the fiber, it's going to push all that out. That has physical weight. Get rid of that. And then the last thing we're going to do is a water load. And there's lots of different ways you can water load. I'm going to say, everyone, you don't have to drink 8 liters of water. Do Reed's math, 100 mils times your body weight in kilograms. And that's probably, I would even say, the upper limit. And then you can work back from that, whatever's comfortable. As long as you're peeing a lot, then it's going to work. But they're the four strategies that you're using. You go, how long do I need to do this for? Again, very individual, very, very individual. I would say for a minimum of 3 days, do these things. For a maximum 7 days. I hear guys doing these strategies for like 10 days, 12 days. I had a guy message me and go, I'm 2 weeks out from a fight. I'm going to start water loading. I was like, nah, not a good idea. Probably not the best idea.
And this is not just like amateur people, like low level competitors. People at the top level in the UFC will do this stuff wrong and will start doing these strategies 2 weeks out, 3 weeks out from a fight and just completely deplete themselves. So yeah, probably 5 days would be like a maximum.
Yeah. I mean, like the UFC PI, like a world-class service who offer it for free for all their athletes, right? And they've only got Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, weigh-in Friday. So what, 3 days essentially to do this process, and it'll work. I think you're going to get a lot better of an outcome if you give yourself at least 5 days with it. 7 days is probably going to be pushing it a bit too much. Because again, you need to remember, if you're still training throughout all this process, and we spoke about it before, your body's going to want carbohydrates during your training. If you're doing all of this, it's probably not going to be the most favorable type of diet in terms of your performance. It's going to be great for cutting weight. It's not going to be great for your performance. So you need to find that balance of like, okay, when have I wound down all my hard training sessions? Now the focus turns to making weight. So let's turn our diet away from a performance-based get me through fight camp diet to, okay, now we need to hit a number on the scale type diet. Yeah,
that's why the planning is essential. So basically getting into a taper week and fight week so you're not depleting yourself even further or making yourself feel a certain way.
Yeah, I think that pretty much covers everything. I think the only thing, because I know someone will be thinking this and I always get this question is, well, how much weight should I be losing when I'm cutting weight? And you go, it's an area of hot debate, right? And we said 10% at the start. 10% at the start. I think if you need to think about what we haven't spoken about is the actual cutting weight.
And just to clarify, that's 10% including all of the stuff we just talked about. That's not 10% in the bath or the sauna.
Yeah. So people will still be getting in a bath and sauna after doing all these things. So they'll cut their carbohydrates, cut their salt, cut their fiber. They'll do a water load and then that'll get them to say Thursday night. And then on Friday, weigh-in day, they're going to jump in a sauna and sweat out. Or they're jumping a bath and they're going to sweat out a certain amount of weight. So combined all of that process, 10%, I think it's very realistic to lose at least 5% from using those strategies that we discussed. And I think losing 1% of your body weight per day, this is why I say do it for 5 days, because that's pretty consistent with practice. You won't read that anywhere, I guarantee. But over the years, 1% of your body weight is an expected weight loss you should see each day during fight week. So do it for 5 days or even 6 days to play it safe. Get up to a point. You want to do that because you don't want to be cutting 10% of your body weight in a bath or a sauna. You want that final number, that final dehydration number, to be as low as possible. You don't want to be sweating, because although it's not ideal or favorable to be manipulating your diet and manipulating fluid out of those compartments, it's not as threatening to your health as what sitting in a sauna and overheating is, or sweating excessively for long periods of time is. So that part is by far the most dangerous and what you want to minimize. And I say to everyone, maximum 5% you want to sweat. And that's for top level guys. If you're more down low, 2-3%, and then rely on 5% here. And that's why we've kind of changed our tone and said, maybe plan when you're going into this fight week, 6-8%. 10% is a lot. Like, you can do it. Your body is very capable of doing it. Is it the best thing for you? Over the years, my consensus is, nah, it's definitely not.
Yeah, I've never seen someone do 10% and feel great on weigh-in day, or even their rehydration or refueling is not compromised. So these days for myself, I like to have male athletes at this elite level under 8% and females under 6%.
Yeah, just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean you should.
Yeah, I think we'll reiterate that point, right? 5% you can bank on pretty easily if you're doing those strategies, given you've prepped your body to do it. Like, you haven't cut carbs, you haven't been eating low fiber, you've got good amount of salt in your diet, you drink a good amount of water every day. Come into fight week, you do those manipulations, 1% per day, you're going to follow that for 5-6 days. You want to ideally wake up on weigh-in day and not be more than 2-3, at best 4-5. That's really pushing it, really, really pushing it. And that's going to be tough. And the thing that people don't realize is that, remember, all of this process, we're manipulating fluid and water in your body. Just because you're not sweating when you're changing your carbs and your fiber doesn't mean that you're not dehydrating yourself, because you are. You're just dehydrating yourself from different components. So when you start that final sweat, you need to remember you're already dehydrated. You're already dehydrated. So people go, oh, no, I can get 3-4% dehydrated and I'll be fine. It's like, yeah, but you already are that. You already are 3-4%, probably 5% dehydrated. So everything we're doing from this point on is in very, very dangerous territory. So just do 1-2, at best 3. And I really get worried about the guys that go all the way up to 5%. I think let's wrap that up there. We'll do rehydration, reloading in another episode. But I think if this is something you guys are struggling with, and it's a lot of athletes that do struggle with it, the biggest reason you probably are is because you're not planning. You're not planning and you don't have an idea how to set it up. You don't know how to get all these numbers, because if you're missing weight or you're struggling, you're missing weight, you should know about it 8 weeks out. Because if you do a correct assessment, you'll know about it. You run all the numbers, you go, this is going to be a shit time for you. Oh, you'll make this weight pretty easy, and here's why. If that's the case, reach out. We're going to help you out. We've got so much resources. You can go to our website. You can download, you can buy and purchase so many different resources. You can reach out, get one-on-one coaching. Go to our Instagram. We put so much free content out for you guys to get better educated. Just don't do it blind. Get educated and do it more smart.